Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here. Home studio, Pond City Market, Atlanta. Mini Crush edition with Noel.
Chuck?
Yes?
I just, like, I don't know. That's just, it's like I'm being too formal. Chuck, how are you?
I'm good, dude.
Good.
How are you? Welcome back to town.
Hey, thanks, man.
You spent a few days in New York City, right?
It's been a whirlwind. Yeah, I saw, have you seen Sleep No More?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's this crazy immersive theater thing that's sort of Macbeth, but it's like being in a video game where you're wandering around this crazy space.
Man.
And it was intense.
I love that you went to Sleep No More.
I love that I did, too. It was wild. I was not expecting it to be so physical. You're running up and down steps the whole time.
Yeah.
You're out of breath. And yeah.
Uh-huh.
But,
and well, you can kind of... You can have whatever experience you want with it, yeah. Which is kind of cool.
But I ended up kind of spazzing out and trying to chase different actors. It's like, it's a very like Alice down through the looking glass kind of experience where you don't really know what's going to be on the other side of the door when you chase something.
Right.
And you lose them immediately, but then you find something that you weren't even looking for.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Go check it out. If anyone's in New York City, check out Sleep No More. It's been running since like 2011. I didn't realize so long.
It's been around. Yeah. And I think that was one of those that was supposed to not run very long.
Yeah.
I think it was supposed to have like a very short run. And then they lit New York on fire, quite literally.
No, mm-hmm.
I'm just kidding.
No, just the theater world.
Well, I hope you had everything you needed for that show, Noel.
Yeah, I did. No, not everything. Just some of the things. Enough of the things. There was a delightful little speakeasy that you walk into and get yourself a $18 cocktail. And yeah,
God bless New York and their $18 cocktails.
Indeed, cheers.
So welcome, everyone, and welcome back, Noel. And this is... another Mini Crush edition. I want to thank everyone for their support for these shows, as always, for chiming in on Facebook when I throw out questions. And we're going to go ahead and just ramp right into it with a social studies segment.
Social studies on Movie Crush.
All right, this week we did all-time favorite animated film. And I think it's interesting. A few people said, including the beloved Sarah Law, said, the Wallace and Gromit things. I know you asked for animated films, but Wallace and Gromit. I was like, Sarah, those are animated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Stop motion animation.
That's right.
Doesn't have to be drawn. Doesn't have to be CGI characters.
I mean, if stop motion is an animation, then CGI definitely is an animation.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So
I'm just going to kind of go through these fast because I want to get as many of them in as I can. Alex Glasanovic says, The Emperor's New Groove. Did not see that. The aforementioned Sarah Law said The Wallace and Gromit, any of those first three movies. Totally agree. Those are beloved by me. If you ever saw the BBC TV series Creature Comforts, that's where those guys, Nick Park and the Aardman Animation Group, that's where that all came from. Check out Creature Comforts if you can. Kelly Kuchin-Talley says Ratatouille. Did not see that, actually.
It's Patton Oswalt's famous turn as the Remy the Rat.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's like a gourmet rat who has really, really amazing taste and is in France and wants to be a chef. It's a delightful little picture.
Yeah, a lot of these got away from me because it was a big gap because Emily hates animated movies. But now that we have a daughter, she's into it. So I'm picking back up again. Tabitha Jimmy says, The Iron Giant for sure. A lot of people said The Iron Giant. It's a wonderful, wonderful movie. So it doesn't surprise me.
I hear it's a real tearjerker. I've not seen it for that reason.
It's good. Most of them are tearjerkers at some point, though. You know?
Yeah, that's true. I always talk about the Pixar effect.
You know,
every time I go to one, especially now that I've got a child. Well, I've had one for 9 years now. But when we go and she's a little more cognizant of things, I always tear up, man, every time. Because like, I always relate it back to our relationship and stuff.
Yeah.
And then she looks over at me and just kind of shamed.
Has she looked at you yet and said, Dad, this is bullshit?
Oh, no. In fact, I'm the one that tells her things are bullshit
okay,
most of the
good.
Time. She really likes some of these Disney pieces of trash, like the ones for teens that I just can't stand. And I try to point out to her why this is bad.
Right.
But it doesn't matter to her.
Andrew Heath says Inside Out. Talk about a tearjerker.
Whew. Yeah, that's amazing. That's kind of the one I'm talking about because that's all about the experience of growing up and being a child and like nostalgia. And you start thinking about your childhood and then my kid and all
yeah.
of this stuff. And it just, whoa, wells right up in you.
Well, the Toy Story series, Rob Dickinson says the first Toy Story, and that is definitely one that will yank your heartstrings in a million directions as that series goes.
For sure.
Because you know at some point that boy's going to grow up. He's going to forget about those damn toys.
Yep.
That's what happens. Spoiler. Sorry.
That's just life, man. There's no, you can't spoil life.
Let me see here. Land Before Time from Kristen Wells. Never saw that one. Spirited Away. I need to see that. I've heard that's wonderful. Don McGoey says Spirited Away. Haunting and beautifully illustrated.
It's fantastic. All those Ghibli. Ghibli? Is it Ghibli? I think it's Ghibli.
I don't know.
Miyazaki, his studio is called Studio Ghibli, and like any of his movies are insane. There's Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away and Howl's Moving Castle and any of those.
Yeah,
they're amazing.
No, well, you know more about the stuff than I do.
Well, he's sort of the Japanese Walt Disney is what people refer to him as.
Oh, really?
Very, very, very prolific and detailed work. Really, really cool.
All right, I'll check it out. Tyler Murphy, Murph, says Lion King. That's always a good one. American Tale, Fran Williams. Wall-E, hands down, from Brandon Johnson. Yeah, Wall-E, that was a good one. I think Emily even saw that one. I managed to drag her to the theater for that. Zach Pointer says, really tough, but it's got to be Aladdin due to Genie. Yeah, Aladdin was classic. The Incredibles, Thor Bonk says The Incredibles, and that's got a sequel coming out soon.
It does, yeah. I feel like I haven't seen that one. It's about the superhero family, right?
Yeah, it's a good one, for sure. Zach Duse, the Disney Robin Hood. Man, that's a good one. The old school Disney Robin Hood.
I like there's the chicken that sings, kind of narrates it in song.
Yeah.
Isn't it the guy that did King of the Road? King of the Road.
Yes, Roger Miller.
That's him, yeah.
Uh-huh. His songs are in that. Mm-hmm. Nice call. Joshua Brennan says, Coco. I got to say, Coco is up there for me, man.
Gorgeous.
One of the best looking movies I've ever seen.
So beautiful. And the story is just.
Very heartwarming.
It hits. It hits. It's not a bummer. It's like it just makes you, fills you with joy.
Yeah, really good one. And for me, I'm gonna say Coco. And then for just my classic grown up years, there is no better movie to me than The Jungle Book. Still one of my favorites. I know all those songs by heart. Sing them to my daughter. She thinks it's hysterical.
Oh, yeah.
Because I sing them in character.
That's great.
It is a lot of fun. Edwin Forrest Glenn, I love that Disney short called Ben and Me when I was a kid. It's about Ben Franklin and the American Revolution. That's a deep cut.
I don't know that one.
The Swan Princess, Jessica Hamilton. Lion King, another one for Lion King, Thomas Mario. I need to check some of these out. Oh, Lady and the Tramp, Janet James Allman. That's a, yeah. So those movies from the 50s and 60s from Disney were really, really great.
Oh, yeah.
And they all hold up.
Gorgeous movies. But yeah, they do hold up. The writing is really good. The story's there. I think that was a big important thing for Walt was the, you know, start with an amazing story and kind of go from there.
Yeah, agreed. All right. Well, that's it for animated film. Sorry if I didn't get to you. I would love to read 400 answers. But then you all would be like, dude, that's not very good programming. All right, so we're going to move on now to a recommended viewing segment. And as everyone knows, I pick out an independent film, a foreign film, and a documentary to recommend. And this week, my independent film is Passion Fish, the great John Sayles movie from 1993. Have you seen this one, Noel?
I have not.
Good one, buddy. Starring the great Mary McDonnell and Alfre Woodard, the great, great Alfre Woodard, and the always amazing David Strathairn, who is a John Sayles regular. And it tells the story of this woman, a soap opera star, Mary McDonnell, who gets injured and paralyzed and is forced to return home to the bayou in Louisiana and to this house where she has a series of nurses coming in to try and care for her. She's an awful person to deal with, angry at what has happened to her, but you also get the sense that she was an awful person before this happened. And then eventually, Alfre Woodard comes in as her nurse that sticks. And basically it's, you know, it's kind of that story that you've seen before. It's nothing revolutionary, but the one nurse who comes in and is just like, you can treat me however you want, lady. I'm not going anywhere. I will take all that you can throw at me. And of course, what happens, they strike up a friendship. Lessons are learned, but it's just a beautiful, beautiful film about human beings and friendship and just a typical John Sayles stuff. Got Best Actress and Best Script nominations for Mary McDonnell and John Sayles for the Oscar. Did not win. And then Best Actress and Supporting Actress for the Golden Globes for both of those women. Highly recommend it.
93, you say?
Yep.
Okay, cool. It kind of made me think of like a movie like Fried Green Tomatoes or something. Is it sort of in that vein a little bit?
No.
No. Okay.
No.
Never mind.
All right, next up, foreign film pick. I'm going to go with Tokyo Story. And this one is the pick of, I don't think it has aired yet, but it is the pick of one of my guests, Loudon Wainwright III. So I hadn't heard of this movie. It's from 1953, directed by Yasujiro Ozu, starring Chishu Ryu and Chiko Higashiyama. I do my best there with the Japanese, everybody.
It's all you can do.
Very tough for me. Tokyo Story, man. So this movie is, it's a bit of a challenge. So if you go to watch it, be patient. You have to sit with it. And there are rewards, is what I will say. There are great rewards if you sit through this movie. It is very slow. It's very languid. It is not something, if you're an American audience, that you may not be used to seeing culturally. This family, it tells a story. Just let me set it up real quick, I guess. The story of an elderly Japanese couple who get to see their children, their grown adult children in Tokyo on a visit. And the children don't have time for their parents, don't make time for their parents, and are kind of shuffling them between each other, and kind of tells a story of these parents who are sort of an afterthought to their kids now. So what you might be used to as an American audience is more emotion and touching. Like, they don't touch one another, they don't hug one another, they don't cry when they're upset. And so it's a little tough to find a way in emotionally as an American, I think. But if you accept it for what it is, which is a viewpoint of a different culture, and you look at the beautiful black and white photography and these understated performances, there are great rewards to watching this film. Really, really good movie. Beautiful photography. It is regarded as one of the all-time great movies of all time. Roger Ebert has hit his one of his great movies lists, and I think it's on some AFI list of top 100 movies of all time. So really, really good story.
So many good, like, reflective, meditative movies in Japanese cinema, the early stuff, like even Kurosawa, like,
yeah.
Ikiru, uh-huh. You know, it's like a meditation on life and death, and it is slow, but it kind of, it's almost like a poem or something. You kind of have to, like, really take it in, you know?
Yep. You got to give a little time. But they are universal themes, you know? It deals with alcoholism and family and relationships in such a real way, and the director will... He just locks down that camera. I don't think there's a camera move in the whole movie. And so you really get to just sit in these scenes. And he will often begin the scenes several beats before anyone comes in, and then hold the camera there several beats after they have left to an empty room, almost to just let you sit with what you've just seen and heard. So highly recommend Tokyo Story. And then finally, documentary Muscle Shoals. Do you see this one, Noel?
I know it's about the studio, right?
Yeah.
Big famed recording studio.
That's right. Called Fame. Greg Freddy Camilleri directed this documentary. And it's about two studios, actually. Initially, the Fame Studio in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and specifically about the Swampers, the Muscle Shoals rhythm section, who played on so many great recordings. And then they eventually left the Fame Studio, started their own Muscle Shoals Studio in Alabama. They're the Muscle Shoals Sound Studio. And just basically tells their story, how everyone, like this middle of nowhere town in Alabama, Mick Jagger's coming through, and Keith Richards, yeah, and Aretha Franklin, and Wilson Pickett, and Paul Simon, and Bob Seger, and like, you name it, man, they're coming through this small town, Greg Allman. And
that's authentic, right? Because like the Stones were so obsessed with like,
oh, yeah,
the blues and like Southern culture or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know,
this
like,
is where you gotta go.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and I think for a lot of these the African American artists like Aretha Franklin and Wilson Pickett, they thought Etta James, they thought, well, we'll go there and record with these black folks who are making this music. They got there, and it's all these kind of square white guys. And they're like, that's who's making that sound. And they're like, great, let's do it.
All right.
And so they ended up recording some of the greatest rhythm and blues and soul music of all time. They recorded with Jimmy Cliff.
Yeah.
Like, everybody used them.
Now, was it Patterson Hood from the Drive-By Truckers? he plays into the story. Like, his father was either a one of the session guys at Muscle Shoals.
He was the bassist.
The bassist. There you go.
Yeah, the founding four were Barry Beckett played keyboards, Roger Hawkins played drums, David Hood, Patterson's dad, played bass, and Jimmy Johnson played guitar.
That's so cool.
And that was the core four, and then, you know, eventually added more players for whatever their needs were.
Patterson Hood of the Drive-By Truckers, a big Athens band, if you haven't checked him
out. Yeah, absolutely.
His kid went to the same Montessori school as my kid, and I'd always see him there, like, dropping his kid off.
Oh, no way.
He's just sort of like a dude around town. It's funny.
Yeah.
He's the sweetest guy.
Yeah, for sure. Aretha Franklin's Respect was recorded by these guys. Mustang Sally, When a Man Loves a Woman, I'll Take You There by the Staple Singers. Wild Horses and Brown Sugar from the Rolling Stones. Oh. It's just off the charts. I think 75 golden platinum hits were recorded by the Swampers. And if you've ever heard the song Sweet Home Alabama by Lynyrd Skynyrd, Muscle Shoals has got the Swampers. They've been known to pick a song or two.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's funny. I never caught that lyric. That's funny.
Yeah, it's really great. So Muscle Shoals tells that story really, really well. And if you're a music fan and a documentary fan, then you can't do much better than this one. Really good stuff. All right. Segment three, Noel. We're going to stick with John Sayles on the highlight reel. You were just saying off mic that you didn't know much about John Sayles.
Well, I looked it up, and I don't recognize a ton of his work. I'm intrigued.
Oh, man, he's the best. He's an indie legend. He started his career, like so many great directors, as a disciple of Roger Corman. Doing script work for hire. He wrote Piranha, the original Piranha movie.
Nice.
He wrote Alligator and The Howling, and used the money from writing these genre pictures to finance these independent films that he started making. His first movie that he wrote and directed was called Return of the Secaucus Seven. He made The Brother from Another Planet. He made Matawan. He made Eight Men Out, the great baseball story.
I have seen Matawan. I love that movie.
Yeah, really
good
movie.
About the coal mining community, right?
Yep.
With a very young Will Oldham, Bobby yes. Prince Billy, playing the preacher boy. That is a cool – I watched that in college, actually, in a class. That is a kick-ass movie.
Yeah, Matawan's great. And Bonnie Prince Billy is a bucket list guest for this show. City of Hope, The Secret of Rowan Inish, Lone Star – Men with Guns, Casa de los Babies. He is just a guy that makes quality movies every time out of the gate. He always, they always have that indie spirit. He varies his genres. He's all over the place. Like, Eight Men Out was the tale of the baseball Black Sox scandal. Matawan was the story of the coal mining. Was it a strike?
Yeah, exactly. Like a labor strike.
Yeah, period piece, of course. Mm-hmm. City of Hope was about the inner city. Return of Secaucus 7 was about a bunch of old friends. Secret of Rowan Inish was a fantasy fairy tale. He is all over the place genre-wise. And no matter what it is that John Sayles takes on, he does a great job. Because at the heart of every single one of these films, they're really about people. And stories about real characters and real people. Passion Fish, the one I just talked about earlier, another great example of a John Sayles film. Sometimes they're set in other countries. Sometimes they're completely in foreign languages. It's like he's essentially making a foreign film. I can't remember where Casa de los Babies was, but I believe that one was mostly subtitled. Often tell stories of minorities, women, people of color. He's just sort of a champion of stories that you don't get to see enough of. And can't recommend any John Sayles film enough. He's still doing it after all these years. Chris Cooper and David Strathairn are a couple of the guys. I think they've been like four or five movies each. Just really, really great filmmaker. And has always stayed true to himself. Never sold out. He'll make his money here and there still for scripting big movies. But he's always remained true to who he is.
Yeah, I think that's what threw me. His IMDb has his writer credits kind of first and foremost.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't have nearly as many director credits, but he's got a shit ton of writing credits. And
I think
some
he
of them
wrote
are,
one of the Jurassic Park movies even.
I would not be surprised.
Which is kind of crazy. But yeah, boy, John Sayles. My hat is off to you, sir. He's another bucket list guest. All right, Noel. Watch some John Sayles.
Oh, I shall.
I say besides Matawan, what am I going to say you should watch? I would say...
Well, Passion Fish, so I can see that it's nothing like Fried Green Tomatoes.
You know what? Watch Lone Star.
Okay.
That's my pick for you.
Is it a horror? It looks like a horror, kind of. It's got a skull on the movie box.
No, it's sort of a modern day Western.
Got it.
But it's about a murder in like a small Western town. Really good movie. Comment card. We're going to finish with questions from you to us. First out of the gate, Jonathan Hand says, what do you think makes a good movie adaptation of a book? Recently, a few of my favorites have been made, Ready Player One, The Martian, and Ender's Game. He liked Ready Player One and Martian, did not like Ender's Game. So I'm going to say kind of broadly, just capturing the essence of that book and getting the casting right are the two most important things.
I always wonder, though, it's like, it's really hard because you're sort of torn between two things. It's like making the movie for fans of the book or just making the movie to be a good movie.
That's what you have to do.
Right.
I think so, too.
I think so, too. But you always end up with like these book fan people that just are going to shred it no matter what.
These readers.
Who's got time for that these days? Come on. But like, you know, the Annihilation, which I loved, the most recent, I forget the director's name, but he did Ex Machina, the really great AI sci-fi movie from a couple years ago. Annihilation is based on a series of books, and it's very clear from the movie that he is not going to make the others, and that it was sort of a mishmash of a lot of stuff from the different books. And it's very well reviewed. I think it's fantastic. But I have a friend who really loved the books, and he was sort of torn by the movie. Like he liked it. On the one hand, he felt like the book was so precious that he felt like it was sort of bastardized a little bit. So that's a weird place to find yourself, right?
I think you have to serve the movie first and foremost.
Yeah.
Because if you're trying to serve the book, you're in trouble. Like, you got to make a good movie. And all you readers out there, I'm doing that voice because of the great Bill Hicks
with
bit.
With your mint juleps.
Did you ever hear, you know, Bill Hicks, a comedian?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
His when he was talking about, he was in like a Waffle House reading a book.
Yeah.
And someone said, why are you reading? And he was like, not what are you reading, why are you reading?
Yeah.
And then he goes in this whole book like, we got ourselves a reader over here, everybody.
That's funny.
The great Bill Hicks.
He's priceless.
So yeah, capture the essence of the book, serve the movie first. And casting is so key.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's like, you know, the Game of Thrones thing is, I'm just going to real quick, like there's so many scenes in the Game of Thrones books that are just painfully long.
Yeah.
And there's like, you know, three pages of describing a banquet table or whatever,
right.
You know? And in the movie, you can accomplish that with like one pan shot, you know?
Exactly.
So, and I really think that the TV show serves the source material almost better than the source material.
Yeah.
Because it like moves the story along
in
a much more timely manner, I think.
Yeah, and I think by essence, that's sort of a weird word to use, but I mean tone, I think is what I mean.
Yep.
Capturing the tone of the books.
For sure.
And then he also asked, what do I want to see made? I've been saying this for years, I want to see the book Middlesex made into a movie.
I feel like we did this bit before on another episode.
I think so.
It's okay, though. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
We contain multitudes.
Ben McVitie says, if you could erase one movie from your memory so that you could see it again for the first time, what would you pick?
That's good.
And I try not to overthink these, Ben. And I went back, and I'm also going to answer this as if it would go back to that time so I could re-experience at that age. And I'm going to go with Raiders of the Lost Ark because that movie, more so than Back to the Future and E.T. and any of those Goonies, any of those classic movies from that age, Raiders knocked me out of my seat. And I wish I could go back and be a kid and see that again for the first time.
Mine's a time and place thing, too. It's a movie that has not aged well and that people kind of rip on a lot, but it's Fight Club because that,
for me,
when I was, you know, I was like in high school or like, you know, like ninth grade or something, 10th grade when that came out. And that twist blew my mind.
Yeah, man.
Wasn't expecting it. Did not see it coming. You look back on it now and you feel like a dope, but I totally was like all on board and all in.
Me too.
And it made me like discover Chuck Palahniuk's books and get a little more into like, I don't know, like I discovered the Pixies because of that movie. There's a lot of things that movie did for me that were interesting. So I would say that.
I'm still behind Fight Club, man. That was a great movie and very, not revolutionary, but just it was an important movie at the time.
I think so, too, but there's a lot of arguments that it's overly misogynistic and blah, 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 but I think that's missing the point, because of course it is.
Yeah, fair enough. But it's also not fair to look at movies through the modern lens. I mean, you can make judgments on them for sure. But at the time, you know, it was a great movie.
Right, well, it's also like, to me, the this isn't a spoiler at all, but there's a scene at the very end of the movie when that iconic Pixie song plays that sort of makes you realize, or at least it did for me, that all of the chaos and psychotic behavior in that movie was all in service of a very small love story.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
Agreed. All right. I read that book, too. Did you read it?
I did.
Yeah. I read a couple of other his, too, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember which one.
Haven't seen a successful adaptation quite like that. Like, there was one with Sam Rockwell.
I saw that and read that. What was that one called?
Choke?
Yeah.
Wasn't my favorite of his books and didn't feel like it needed to be made into a movie.
Nah, movie wasn't great.
It was very forgettable.
Lisa Potts says, do you think movies overdo special effects now? Yes.
But then there's also backlash where we have this cool resurgence of, like, practical effects.
Well, sure.
Which is neat.
Yeah.
Because there's always the pendulum swings both ways, right?
Like, yeah. I think for me, overusing special effects is not so much like – I think they overuse it with backdrops and more than anything.
I see.
Like, you know, I miss the days where a battle scene had – like 500 people out there and not like, let's have 10,000 CG people.
Right.
You know, get 500 people out there.
It's kind of Lord of the Rings fault.
It's, well, I lay a lot at the feet of Lord of the Rings, blame-wise.
But is that was the first time they were able to really do that super well, kind of, you know? Arguably compared to maybe what you'd seen in the past. And so then it became the fad, the fashion to just do that, you know?
Yeah, I think I'm just still mad at Lord of the Rings because it overshadowed Master and Commander at the Oscars all year long.
Yeah, I didn't see Master and Commander.
Oh, man, that fucking movie is so good.
Okay.
Like, you watch Master and Commander, and you're like, is this real? Like, did they travel back in time and capture a story on film? It's that believable and that real. But by the great Peter Weir. And Lord of the Rings, they tried out a bunch of CG. No, don't get me started.
Okay, I'm going to reel you back in, Chuck.
Yeah, I think they overdo it now, but thankfully we are seeing a return. And the other thing that bugs me about CG is animals. Like when, you know, used to have, what's the DiCaprio one recently where he was, the period piece where he was attacked by a bear? And
oh, yeah, that was The Revenant.
Yeah, The Revenant. Yeah. Like, they used a bear.
That was a bear.
But then they also mixed in a little CG, but they did it well. But
right.
When they're just trotting out completely fake-looking CG animals all over the place, I miss the days where they had the real tiger and the real bear and the real deer running across the screen.
Again, though, I feel like that backlash is interesting because you start to see real auteurs – it being very important to them to do that, you know?
Sure.
Like, Del Toro is a good example. Like, I know how you were lukewarm about Shape of Water.
Benicio Del Toro?
Yes, that one, that guy. But, you know, you can't deny that the practical effects in that movie were pretty arresting.
That was a guy in a suit.
Yeah.
And it looked great. Mm-hmm. And it looked way better than CGI.
Totally.
E.T. looked great because it was a real thing in three dimensions.
I got to go to Lucasfilm recently for in Industrial Light and Magic for work, and on the walls in that it's an office. They don't even hardly shoot anything there anymore. You're just walking around this giant like office, but on the walls are all these matte paintings that are done on shower doors, and it's like this giant slab of glass with like the LA cityscape from E.T. on it. And there are little spots where there's holes punched in it, and they would light these things from the back, right? Uh-huh. And they would use it as like, this is the LA. And if you step back enough, even in the room, it looks pretty convincing. But then you kind of walk in, you can see the brush strokes and stuff. But that's fucking cool.
Yeah, man. Yeah. If you go to New York, next time you go to the
Museum of the Moving Image, I think is what it's called.
I think that's it. In Queens?
I've heard good things.
It's great. I went a couple of years ago because they had a Mad Men exhibit, and they have, you know, they're like all museums, like their rotating featured thing, but they have quite a few great things on display at all times. And one of the things they had was the original model from Blade Runner of the what's the name of the company?
Tyrell?
The Tyrell Corporation. Yeah. And it's one of those where like they put lights in there, and they shine through the little holes poke.
Yeah.
And they film it with a camera, and it's in three dimensions, and it looks amazing.
Yep. Yeah.
Really cool stuff.
Very cool.
All right. Old men going on a rant.
You are much older than me, Chuck.
How old are you?
34.
Oh, Jesus. Nicole Parks. Man, 34 is a good age, Noel.
Not much. Come drink on. I'm joking with you.
Are you kidding me? I'm 46.
Okay. Well, you look good, Chuck.
I'm 47.
Well, you look good for 47.
God. If I shave my beard, I would look 38.
Well, don't ever do that. It will scare your child. And I can tell you that from experience. I did that one time.
Oh, did
and
it?
My kid, she was like out? 4, and she did not recognize me, and she freaked out. Seriously,
Nicole Park says, if you could date any character from a movie, who would it be? This is easy for me. I'm going with Jake Ryan from 16 Candles.
I haven't seen a lot of those movies.
Oh, man.
Breakfast Club and 16 Candles. I need to go back.
He was handsome. He was preppy. Yeah. He drove a Porsche.
Yeah.
He was
a real dreamboat.
He was cool.
Yeah.
He was a total dreamboat.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Jake Ryan.
Cool. Well, I'm going to watch that movie, and then I'll agree with you.
16 Candles, some of those John Hughes movies now don't reflect well through today's lens.
Mm.
I know I just said that. That's unfair.
Yeah.
But like blatantly racist characters Emilio Alvarado. Emilio Alvarado says, who's your favorite villain in a film and why? I picked a couple here. I'm going to go with 3, actually. I'm going to go with Annie Wilkes from Misery because she's Kathy Bates. And she's Annie Wilkes in Misery. And she was creepy and scary while being who she was, which was vanilla, seemingly sweet and good, which it makes for complexity of character, which always makes for a better character.
And it took her a while to like simmer over into full-on
crazy
switch. Town, you know? And even then, she kind of did it like, I'm doing you a favor.
Yeah.
I'm doing all this for you, for us.
Such a good movie.
Yeah, it's very cool.
Frank Booth from Blue Velvet, genuinely one of the most disturbing, threatening characters I've ever seen in a movie was Dennis Hopper as Frank Booth in Blue Velvet. And then I'm going to pick Nurse Ratched from Cuckoo's Nest. Who was that? Louise Fletcher, I believe.
I think you're right, yeah.
I think she won an Oscar for that, too. Boy, Nurse Ratched, one of the great all-time villains. If you haven't seen that movie, check it out. She did such a good job as the steely, reserved, keeping it all together Nurse Ratched.
But with also like a real mean streak.
A mean, manipulative streak, though, but also contained, which made it even better.
Oh, big time. Yeah, love that film.
You got anything else, Noel?
Just intense characters, intense villains.
Yeah, favorite villains.
You named some of my favorites, dude.
Yeah,
that's for sure. Yeah, I'm gonna go with. I'm just gonna leave it be. That's a really good list.
All right. We're gonna wrap it up for this week then. Thanks, everybody. Your homework coming up this Friday. Our new pal, Aaron Mankey, the great podcaster of lore fame, is now with our company. He's gonna do some podcasting with us.
Pretty exciting.
Yes, so excited about, because Aaron is not only insanely talented, but turns out he's a great dude.
Very down to earth, very fun to talk to, and very just razor sharp guy.
Yeah, super smart, great podcaster. And watch the movie The Village. That was Aaron's pick, which is really kind of fit. When he told me The Village was his movie pick, it all made sense, because if you're a fan of lore, and you know the movie The Village from M. Night Shyamalan, then it all kind of makes sense. So watch The Village this week and look for Aaron Mankey on Friday. And thanks for joining us this week and contributing on Facebook. And we'll see you next time. Goodbye.